Truth Seekers, it is I, no, not Mike Malloy, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, in for Mike, who is a bit under the weather today. He'll be back with us live on Monday. Hope you don't mind having me sitting in. I'm delighted to be here. Got a huge show lined up for you tonight. Dennis Kucinich is going to be joining us in a minute to talk about what? Progressivism in healthcare. Yeah, it's alive and kicking just barely. We're going to get details on that and his fight for single payer. The crumbs that we're scraping for at this point, maybe the crumbs are that we're allowed to have single payer. Well, we're allowed to let states have single payer if they want it in healthcare. We're going to talk to him about that shortly. Also, Igor or Igor Volsky, I got to find out. Igor Volsky? I don't know. Center for American Progress, he's going to talk to us also about healthcare. Almost the first whole hour here, we're going to be talking about healthcare. 877-520-1150 is our phone number, unlike Mike's usual number. So write that down. I'll try to take as many of your calls as I can throughout the night. 877-520-1150. Later, Don Siegelman, yes, Governor Don Siegelman is going to be joining us and hopefully taking your calls. He is still fighting his case. He's still out on appeal. Some absolutely startling new evidence in his case. His star witness was cajoled, was coached, was threatened by the feds. It's absolutely remarkable. This testimony, looked at it this week, wrote about it at bradblog.com. Cannot believe that this case has not been thrown out yet. Where the hell are you, Eric Holder? Threw out the Ted Stevens case up there in Alaska because of prosecutorial misconduct. The prosecutorial misconduct in this case makes the Ted Stevens case look like jaywalking. It is unbelievable what these guys were doing and the fact that they lied about it to the judge, to the defense team. They didn't turn over material on this guy, and he was, Nick Bailey is the guy's name, he was their star witness. And pretty much it seems to me in reading his declaration that ultimately he kind of made the whole thing up. At least the words that he used were, you know, forced on him by the feds because Nick Bailey was trying to shorten his own sentence. So, yes, we're going to talk to the governor about that. That's going to be coming up next week. The government has to reply to Siegelman's call for a new trial. And frankly, at this rate, he should have a lot more than a new trial. They should vacate the whole damn thing. It's absolutely an outrage. John Bonifaz, the legal director from Voter Action, is going to be here. They are trying to get something moving for election reform. Get rid of the damn machines, the voting machines, the touchscreen machines. A lot of you folks, listeners, may know me, may know BradBlog.com for our coverage of election fraud and most notably electronic voting machines that got to go. So we're going to talk to John Bonifaz about that. The state of legislation right now in the House. Also joining us tonight, A.K. Muckraker. And I got to find out, do we know if she's, we don't know if she may or may not be outed her name. We'll find out. I know her name, and I think she's now, we're allowed to say it. As a matter of fact, for a while, nobody even knew it was a she, I think. But anyway, A.K. Muckraker is going to join us to speak about, yes, the soon-to-be former governor, Sarah Palin, who aborted her first term in order to become, apparently, a celebrity community organizer. And apparently, she is not. She's staying true to form. She's lying on her way out the door. She's facing more ethics charges. It looks to me, as I wrote about yesterday at Brad Blog, it looks to me like her lawyer, and possibly her, have defamed the woman, Kim Chapman, who filed one of the ethics charges that were brought against her, one of the ethics complaints that were brought against Sarah Palin, the one in which it was found a probable cause was found, according to a leaked report this week, that she used her office for personal gain in her legal defense fund. So we're going to talk about that. We got plenty to talk about. And your calls all here today. 877-520-1150 is our phone number. I think we're going to... Dennis, is that the congressman calling in on the line? I think it is. So we will have him in a minute. You know, it's amazing that we are stuck at this point talking about the single payer and trying to get permission from Congress to allow states to enact single payer if they want. And this is what Congressman Kucinich had to get through a committee last week. I believe he was successful in having done that. Whether it stays in the bill before it gets passed, I don't know. At this rate, I think anybody who tells you what's going to be in that final health care bill is probably a liar. Harry Reid, however, I almost said speaking of liars, but I won't. Harry Reid, because I don't think he's not a liar. He just needs to be replaced as majority leader in the Senate. He said today that they are not, in fact, going to be able to get health care done prior to the August break when President Obama had asked them to do so. So it's going to be more like, September, October, fall, if at all, because there is a full court press now from the Republicans, a misinformation campaign, an extraordinary misinformation campaign from the Republicans. They don't give a damn about health care. All they give a damn about is killing it. And I thought if you watched the press conference last night, Barack Obama was, well, he could have been a lot... He has not cashed in his political capital yet. Let's put it that way. He could have been a lot stronger on this. He was quite gentle, I think, when they asked him about the Republicans and their attempts to kill this bill. And he said his concern was the misinformation that is going out there. Well, it's a lot more than misinformation. It is a full court press to kill health care, to do anything they can to kill health care reform in this country. I personally find that outrageous. I find it appalling. I find the fact that the Democrats really aren't out there calling the Democrats on this, calling them for what it is that they're actually doing. That's what the Democrats need to be. But the Democrats' own house ain't clean either, particularly when it comes to the Blue Dogs. A report out today shows that the Blue Dog Democrats are rolling in money this year. Yeah, the so-called conservative Democrats, they're not conservative, they're corporatist Democrats. Apparently 54% of the money that they're bringing in, these Blue Dog Democrats, comes from the healthcare industry, the the energy companies, and the banking sector. 54% of their money. So I wonder what side they're going to fall on when it comes to energy legislation, healthcare legislation, and, of course, the banking industry. Just take a guess. Well, you know, and frankly, they're not the worst of it. I mean, the Republicans are the worst of it, but it's not only the Blue Dog Democrats. The rank-and-file Democrats, unfortunately, aren't as strong as they ought to be. They ought to be out there. They ought to be raising hell. And really, they're not. They're playing it nice. I don't think they yet know who it is that they're dealing with. And the lengths to which these guys, these Republicans and their buddies in the healthcare industry are willing to go to kill healthcare reform altogether. That's it. They're not fighting for their own healthcare. As a matter of fact, today it came out that the promise of an alternative plan, the Republicans had promised to, they said they were drafting their own, the GOP was going to draft their own health bill. Nope, not so much. They made it up. They ain't going to present a plan at all. Congressman Kucinich is now joining us, I think, from Ohio. Congressman, how are you, sir?
Good evening from Washington, D.C. We're still in session.
Oh, okay. Oh, man, you're still in session. Now, I thought you were out there actually with Obama in Ohio. Wasn't he in Ohio today?
President was in Ohio today, but since the House was in session, this is where I work, so... we had like 20 votes this afternoon, so I was... I was here.
Well, I'm glad you were there doing it because, frankly, Congressman, without you to try to push for some kind of progressivism, some kind of scrap, some kind of crumbs, give me a sense. I know you fought last week in committee to get the approval for a single payer to allow states to have single payer if they want. Is that about the best that we can ask for in regards to single payer in this health care reform, Congressman?
Well, I mean, if the country wasn't in shackles formed by the insurance companies, we would be able to have a single payer system embodied in H.R. 676, the bill I drafted with John Conyers, that is Medicare for All. But the amendment that I was able to get, the Kucinich Amendment to the Education and Labor Committee, makes it possible for states to be able to form their own single-payer system and take care of the broad-based health care needs of people at a state level if they don't like the federal plan. And frankly, this would be very powerful if we were able to keep this in the bill, and that's what we're fighting to do right now.
If that provision, if that amendment was not able to stay in the bill, it's not a matter of, well, would the bill say that you could not have a single-payer option?
No, here's the way it works. The Employee Retirement Income Security Act, ERISA, has a provision in it that says that any states, that all states have to have uniform employer-related benefits. They can't have a motley collection of different plans.
Right.
And so there's a number of case law. There's case law and there's emerging cases that have interpreted ERISA as basically barring states from having a single payer plan. So what I did was to write an amendment that would give the states a waiver from the ERISA provision that says that federal law preempts state law on employee-related health care plans. And so in doing this, we set the stage for states to be able to go into this single-payer, not-for-profit health care business. And this is a big deal because there are a dozen states who have various stages of single-payer activity going on. And if the federal government's plan doesn't meet the experiential approval of people, we'll, you know, states will be ready in the wings to produce their own plan.
And what are the chances at this point that provision that passed in that one committee that it's actually going to be able to make it through all the way through this bill and until it gets signed? Is there?
Well, it may help save the bill, you know, because there's many provisions in the bill that people are having difficulty with, such as the fact that we're going to be giving the insurance companies tens of millions more customers. We're going to be requiring people to have insurance. There'll be there'll be 17 million Americans who are not going to be covered for various reasons. And the bill has some problems. But if the provision was in that bill to permit states to go forward with their own experimentation and create a single-payer system, that would, I think, cure a lot of the problems of the bill because it would give states the ability to bounce back and create something better than the federal government has created, will create.
And you feel that Progressive Caucus would come along if that stayed in the bill in general?
Well, I can't speak for the Progressive Caucus on this because there's, you know, and frankly, since we don't have a bill and it keeps changing, my guess is that this state single-payer provision could be decisive in helping the bill pass because there's so many different levels of negotiation going on right now, and every level that I'm hearing about is not particularly favorable towards a health care bill that's going to meet the broad-based health care needs of the American people.
Okay, and I know you got to go, so very quickly, Congressman Kucinich, what is it that Americans can do? I know that you know Republicans are a problem, but the Democrats are a problem here. Who do we pressure? Who do we call? How do we take action to make sure that at least your provision stays in?
Well, this is going to be up to individual members of Congress, and it's going to be very important for people to call their individual member of Congress and ask that member to make an effort to keep the Kucinich Amendment in the final bill. And some of them may may need to be instructed that it was an amendment to the Education and Labor Bill version of H.R. 3200, which is the health care legislation that the Obama administration is trying to guide through Congress.
So if we tell them, keep the Kucinich Amendment, they'll know what that means.
State single payer.
And single payer. You got it.
State single payer.
State single payer, right.
And I want to thank your listeners and you for your steadfast support of health care as a basic human right. Thank you so much.
And thank you for what you did in New Hampshire last year, fighting for every vote. Much appreciated. Congressman Dennis Kucinich from Ohio's 10th District. Keep up the good fight, my friend. Brad Friedman in for Malloy, back right after this. Mike Malloy Show. Wait, I hope to get it up to that doctor, give me the news, but, you know, we make it up as we go along, right, Tony? All right, Brad, in for Malloy tonight, all night long. We ran late in that last segment with Congressman Kucinich. It is his fault. He's late. He's always late. That's what you get from these progressives. You can't trust them. Anyway, so we're going to got a very short segment here. Then we're back with Igor Volsky, and we will try to take your calls along with Igor, talking about health care for the rest of this hour. 877-520-1150. Is our special number, live from Los Angeles tonight, in for Malloy, who is out sick. But he will be back on Monday, never fear. So we are broadcasting from Burbank, California. Lovely, beautiful Hollywood, California. So we have a different number, 877-520-1150. Igor Volsky from the Center for American Progress. We're going to find out what the hell is going on with healthcare. Will we ever actually get it? Oh, and then Don Governor Siegelman is coming up in the next hour after that. Stay tuned. Much more straight ahead. Brad, in for Malloy. See, you gotta let it play, Tony. No?
You need my love, baby.
Come on, keep it, you know, keep it rocking. There you go.
You're not the only one I've ever had.
What? It's Kiss. It's gotta, you know, here we go. It's coming up now. Here we go. Here you go. Crank it. That's right. Here I am, Dr. Love, Brad Friedman, in for Mike Malloy tonight and tomorrow. Mike's out sick, but he will be back in good form next week. We're talking health care. Speaking of which, see, Malloy is, he's out sick, so we're talking about health care. Igor Volsky is going to be joining us momentarily from the Center for American Progress. Health care all this hour, along with your calls, 877-520-1150. Governor Siegelman and much more coming up in the next hour. In the meantime, you're invited to the Chevy Open House. We've made it easy to get into a new Chevy with low, straightforward pricing on remaining 08 and 09 models. It's simple. The price on the tag is the price you pay. Well, that is simple. Go to Chevy.com/openhouse for details. Excludes Corvette ZR1 at participating dealers only. Come on, people. We got cars to move. All right. Speaking with, where are we here? Igor. There we go. Igor Volsky. Let me make sure I've got that right. There we go. Hey, Igor. It's Igor, not Igor, correct?
Igor, yes.
All right. Igor Volsky is a healthcare researcher and blogger at American Progress, focusing on healthcare issues. He's also a contributor, along with our friend Faz Shakir, I should add, for, also from the Center for American Progress, to Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform, How We Can Achieve Affordable Medical Care for Every American and Make Our Jobs Safer. That's a long book title.
Yeah, you got the whole subtitle in there, too. I'm impressed.
Well, wanted to get it in. I think it's actually, that's the important part, frankly, making it affordable and making our jobs safer, because right now, this has become little more than a political hot potato. And I'm going to talk about with you, Igor, some of that, some of the politics here. But for the moment, if I can, it's not easy, but let's move that aside. The bill that is currently being worked on, let's say it gets passed. Are we going to have real health care reform in this country? Is it going to make a difference? Are you impressed with what the actual bill says, setting aside the politics?
Well, as you know, there are several bills. There's one bill out of the Health Committee in the Senate. There's a bill, the Tri-Committee bill in the House, and we're still waiting on a version from the Senate Finance Committee.
Right.
I think the bill from the House is probably our best chance at getting real reform, and as we write in the book, real reform has to include a public option. It has to give people a choice between private and public coverage. And not just any kind of public option, but a public option that can really lower costs, insert competition into the marketplace, and bring about the kinds of innovations and payments that will help make sure that we don't increase the deficit with reform in the long term, to make sure it's sustainable, to make sure that we pay providers for giving quality care, not just quantity of care. And a public option is really, you know, the cornerstone for achieving all of those goals. So I think any reform has to include a public option. The president has said so just as recently as Monday. He
right.
hosted a call with bloggers, and he said he wants to see a robust public option. Now, we don't know what the Senate Finance Committee is planning. We know Max Baucus is being slammed by fellow Democrats. We're being a bit secretive, so we'll see what they come up with. But I think we're all encouraged, and we're very encouraged when the House bill came out, because it had a good public plan.
And what happened, the fact that we're fighting for a public option versus single payer, was something that was just never going to happen? Single payer was never on anybody's real radar in Congress? Is that just gone?
I think that's right. And as the president has said, if we're rebuilding a system from scratch, then maybe single payer would be a good place to start. But given that we have about 160 million Americans in employer-based coverage, it's very difficult, just logistically, to move all of those people into some kind of government-run plan. So I think it's unrealistic politically. It's logistically problematic. You're going to have millions of people fall through the cracks. So I think that this hybrid approach that the president has proposed, where he builds up what works in the system, mm-hmm. the employer model, and he patches up what doesn't, the individual market, is really kind of the best we can do in this kind of environment.
All right, and let's move on a little bit to the politics here. And by the way, we'll take your calls if we can fit them in. 877-520-1150. And I'm told I keep forgetting to mention, go to bradblog.com. If you like, we've got an open thread at the very top of the blog. Just hit the comments section and then keep hitting refresh, and you can play along at home. And I'll do my best to keep an eye on that. Agent 99 is your lovely hostess there tonight, as always. The public option, are you confident at this point, at least, that the public option is going to stay in there? I know that Obama has said that he said that he wants one. I don't know that I heard him say he's insisting on one. But are we confident that that is going to be in whatever does come out in the end?
We're hopeful, I think. And again, it depends what kind of public option we'll get. Remember, the Senate bill, the health bill, also has a public option. Mm-hmm. It's not as robust as the House version. So I think the bill that's going to come out of conference is going to be tricky, and I think we'll have to wait and see. I think whatever comes out, we won't see a Medicare-like program, which is what we're hoping for.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see something that will move us in that direction.
And who's the real, you know, we know what the Republicans are doing. We know that they want to see this killed. They have no interest in any kind of health reform whatsoever. To them, it's a political game, period, and they think they can somehow that they'll win if they keep any kind of health care reform.
Orrin Hatch said just today that this will be a great victory for us in 2012 if we defeat the president on health care reform. It's politics, pure and simple.
Which is amazing, because Chuck Grassley has also noted, and I think it was at Think Progress today, that there's a new poll out showing that people are blaming the health care companies and the Republicans in huge numbers if health care doesn't pass. So I'm not sure it's such a great victory for them, frankly, if they do manage to kill this thing.
I think that's right.
But setting them aside, because we know they're against it, we know they want to kill it. Is the real problem here really the Blue Dog Democrats, the so-called conservative, and they're not conservative, they're corporatists, but are they the real holdup here, and will the Blue Dogs come around?
The Blue Dogs are certainly part of the problem. You have this interesting dynamic where the Blue Dogs say that they want to control costs and they want to make sure they bend the curve, you know, make sure that health reform doesn't add to long-term deficits. But then many of them, some support the public option, but many of them oppose the public option, which would do just that. It would lower costs. And again, that's not just me talking or Jacob Hacker or the many progressives who have, you know, who have put forth this idea of public option that would increase competition, that would lower premium rates.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the Congressional Budget Office, which said in their analysis of the House bill that the public option would reduce premiums by 10%. So we know it's going to control costs. It's going to save about $150 billion. That's a rough estimate that's been reported. And the Blue Dogs, officially, their official position is that they're against it. So you have this interesting contradiction where, A, they say they want to control costs, but then they refuse to vote and support policies that do just that.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because, and then that was sort of my point when I say they're not conservative. It's not about, look, I'm happy to see that there, frankly, is someone holding the firewall and saying, look, we need to, you know, stick with pay as you go. We can't increase the deficit. Is there a way that we can do this by lowering costs, et cetera, et cetera? That's fine, and I'm glad there's someone legitimately in there fighting for that. But that's not the sense that I get from the Blue Dogs. As you suggest, I think there's something else going on here, that they are such in the pockets of these healthcare companies that maybe they join with the Republicans, frankly, and would be just as happy if this didn't pass.
I think you're right. Given the fact that 14,000 Americans are losing coverage every single day.
Every day.
Every day. So now we're saying we're not going to get reform. We're not going to pass anything in the Senate before the recess. So that means that if you count between recess to Labor Day, that's about 500,000 Americans who are going to lose their coverage. And I think when these Congress people go back to their districts and they hear about the trouble their constituents are having with affording health care, with finding affordable health care, keeping their plans, I think that maybe they'll realize that something has to be done. But ultimately, everyone has a choice, and the choice is their constituents or insurance companies. And as you point out, too many Democrats and most Republicans right now are choosing the insurance companies.
Yeah, I think they are, and I hope that folks will give them hell when they come home for their August recess and let them hear about it and tell them enough is enough of this crap. Hey, Igor, you want to stick around and take some calls on this with me after the break? Awesome. Igor Volsky from the Center for American Progress, healthcare researcher and blogger over there. He's going to be with us here for the rest of the hour, along with your calls. If you're on the line, got a bunch of callers, stay right there. We will try to get to you. Governor Siegelman coming up next hour, and John Bonifaz of Voter Action. Oh, it's a big, big show. I'm Brad, in for Malloy, back with much more right after this. Wake them up, Tony. Brad Friedman in for Malloy on the Mike Malloy program. Good stuff. I like it. It's not too late for that. We'll slow it down in the next hour or two, maybe, if we're in the mood. Brad Friedman in for Malloy, speaking with Igor Volsky of the Center for American Progress. And let me get him back on and let's take some calls here. If I can figure, you know, last time I was in, the folks over at DU, the Truth Seekers over there, they were making fun of me because I couldn't operate the phones. Yeah, see, I'm watching you Truth Seekers over there at DU. Watch your step. Igor, would you like to take some calls?
Please.
All right. Let me get to, Tennessee is perfect. Tennessee. Ellen in Cookeville, Tennessee. You got some blue dogs down there. Welcome to the Malloy Show, Ellen.
Oh, do we ever?
Yeah, I'll say. And you need to, and they're coming home, by the way, in a couple of weeks. Remember, kick their asses, Ellen.
Well, believe me, I do it. Okay. And, you know, I do it here locally and at Call DC, but we've got a pretty hopeless one actually down here. But listen, I enjoy when you fill in, Brad. I have enjoyed listening to you in the past, and I really wanted to call on the topic tonight because I heard a gentleman by the name of Bruce Dixon talking about an article he had just written, and I'd like to just mention if anyone interested would Google Black Agenda. That's all you have to Google. The first hit will come up, the Black Agenda Report. And the main article, in this is the name of it is the Obama health care plan really better than nothing? It was posted on 7/22. It is excellent. And I'm sorry I can't be quite as hopeful as the gentleman from Center for American Progress. This was a really well written article, and I hope you and your listeners will, you know, check it out. But it really,
well, give us the skinny. What's the case that it makes? Very quickly,
in a nutshell. Okay, in a nutshell. Of course, I'm a single payer person anyway, and so anything less than that, I wouldn't be totally satisfied. But it's just pointing out, Brad, that this bill, the Committee bill that he's talking about, the House bill, has a very puny and very weak little public option. Plan in it. For instance, this plan is, instead of covering about 130 million people, it's shrunk to only 10 million. It's about what they're projecting to bring into it. It doesn't start till 2013 as far as even trying to put it together. And he tells a lot of history. For instance,
all right, actually, don't go into the history, Ellen, because I got a bunch of other callers I want to get to, and I want to get Igor's thoughts on that.
He just makes some really excellent points. And what I'm saying is we need to push them more to the left and to get a stronger public option.
Thanks for that call.
I hope you all may read this, and what you do, just keep on these folks. That's what we need to do.
Thanks, okay? Ellen. I appreciate that. You can go to blackagendareports.com and get more on that. Igor, your thoughts? Is the Obama health care plan really better than nothing?
Well, I think it is really better than nothing. Alan, the caller, is right that the new public option will only see about 10 million people. The exchange as a whole will see 30, so we'll see 20 million in private insurance within the new exchange and 10 million in a public plan. I don't think that's a bad deal. I think making sure that 97% of Americans, and that's what the CBO says, that under the House bill, 97% of Americans will now be insured, is better than what we have today. Is it perfect? It's not. Is it viable? I think it is.
And I'm with you on that. While I think we need a more progressive option, I think the trick here ultimately is getting something done, making the sea change, bringing the reform, and I guess if you have to improve it later, so be it. Let's go to John in North Hollywood, listening on K-Talk AM 1150. Hey, John, welcome to the Malloy Show. What's up?
Hello. Well, I just have to say that 30 million people being represented in the health care reform, that's not enough. That's not enough. That's not good enough. What I wanted to say, though, in calling, was that this health care reform seems to represent a sort of, deprivatization that's going on. It's a deprivatization of the healthcare industry in this country.
Deprivatization, okay.
Yes.
Right.
And also, it's a justice issue in terms of looking at it instead of a privilege, a right.
Yep.
Now, the way I look at this Harry Reid comment, they're waiting for their vacation, after their vacation,
right.
And even listening to Igor talk about how 30 million is good enough for now. No, I don't agree with that, because justice delayed is justice denied.
And if the alternative, John, were that we got no health care reform, would that be better?
Oh, obviously not. But one of the things that I wish to suggest to people in this country, the listeners, is that it might be a good idea if a little pressure, more pressure, were brought to bear upon the our representatives in Washington.
Well, which is what I
by
say,
making
John.
Making them stay in session during their vacation.
Sounds good to me, John. I got to roll along. Thanks. Keep them in session. That sounds like a fine idea to me. I doubt that it's going to happen. Your thoughts, Igor? I heard you mention that it was going to be more than 10 million that got insured. By this, you felt.
Well, Brad, just to be clear, 30 million people will be in the new exchange. We're also expanding Medicaid, so we're going to have millions of Americans in Medicaid, and we're going to have more Americans in employer-based coverage.
Yeah.
By 2017, the number of Americans in employer coverage will increase by about 2 million, so that in total we'll have 97% of all Americans insured. So it's more than that 30 million number. That 30 million is only about the exchange. Now, in terms of Harry Reid, it's a setback, no question. The president wanted to get it done by August, and now it looks like we're going to have to wait. But I think that it's easy to get lost in kind of the day-to-day media coverage of who's up, who's down, which
right.
Blue Dog opposes this. I think stepping back for a moment and seeing that the Health Committee passed the bill. We had a bill go through two committees in the House. The AMA endorsed reform. Target joined Walmart in supporting an employer mandate. These are all serious accomplishments in the way to reform. So I think we're headed in the right direction. We're moving along. And now it's just that final push. And as I think the president said last night, that's where it gets difficult when you get close.
Yeah, you're right. And I do recognize that, you know, what a huge effort this truly is. Whether we succeed at it, whether what we get is better than what we got now, remains to be seen. But it is an extraordinary effort. To that end, I'll give them, an inch, but not more. In the meantime, I'm looking at the callers we're not going to be able to get to, but, Frank says single payer is bad, France is better, AC says the fix is in, Obama is compromised, Steve says Congress doesn't care, and it won't matter. I think there's a lot of angry people out there, Igor, and they want
Absolutely.
Something done here.
And I hope they hold this Congress and this president to the fire.
Thank you, sir. Igor Volsky, healthcare researcher at Center for American Progress. Thank you, my friend. Good talking to you.
Thank you, Brad.
All right. Back with much more, including Don Siegelman, right after this. Blog.com back with you here on the Mike Malloy Show. Mike is out sick, so I'm here today and tomorrow. He'll be back with you in fine fettle on Monday. You don't hear that much anymore, do you? Fine fettle. Please stop by if you like over at bradblog.com. We've got an open thread going on there. Love to have your thoughts concerning Governor Don Siegelman or anything else that's on your mind. He's going to be joining us here momentarily. Our phone numbers are not Mike Malloy's normal phone number, since we're broadcasting from lovely Los Angeles at AM KTalk AM 1150. Our numbers are now 877-520-1150 if you'd like to get into the show and have your voice heard. Over the break, I was told someone called in and said I sound like a right-winger. Okay, then. Really? Do I? please stop by bradblog.com and give me your feelings on that. If you think I'm a right winger, man, I don't know what you're paying attention to. Apparently, you ain't reading bradblog.com. Coming up shortly, as I said, Don Ziegelman's going to be with us. John Bonifaz from Voter Action is going to be with us at the bottom of the hour. Next hour, AK Muckraker from Alaska talking about everyone's famous, soon-to-be former governor, celebrity community organizer, Sarah Palin, yeah. So we're going to be talking about that and whatever else is on your mind. First, though, going to go to Governor Don Siegelman, who has been, a frequent guest on the Mike Malloy program. We're glad he's back now to talk about some of this extraordinary, frankly, extraordinary new evidence in his case. He has now filed a motion for a new trial, which, for my money, given the way the prosecutors carried out this case under the under the Bush-Cheney Department of Justice, should I call that the Bush-Rove Department of Justice? Should I call that the Karl Rove Department of Justice? The way the misconduct, the prosecutorial misconduct that went on, that has now been revealed in this new evidence, the testimony that their star witness that spoke against Governor Siegelman was cajoled and threatened by the prosecutors is absolutely remarkable. Governor Siegelman joins us from Alabama now. Former Governor Siegelman joins us. So welcome back to the Mike Malloy Show, Governor.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be back. I thought for the sake of those listeners who may not be familiar with the story, let me just give a minute synopsis. I was prosecuted for something that the New York Times has said has never been considered a crime in America. That is, I appointed a contributor. It wasn't even a contributor to my campaign, but it was a contributor to a statewide referendum that I was promoting to establish free college education for Alabama high school kids. And I reappointed him to a board on which he had served through three previous governors. The Republican State Attorney General in Arizona on CBS's 60 Minutes said that there were so many red flags in this case that he could only conclude that the Republicans could not beat me fair and square, so they targeted me with this prosecution. Time magazine ran a piece a little over a year ago where they described how I was selectively prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
But I was targeted by Karl Rove's client in Alabama just days after I became the first Democratic governor to endorse Al Gore when he was running for president. And I was brought to trial 1 month before the Democratic primary when I was running for re-election by Karl Rove's best friend. A best friend's wife, who is the U.S. attorney.
Just to fill that out, Karl Rove's best friend was the husband to the U.S. attorney who was in the process of prosecuting you, correct?
He not only was the husband of the U.S. attorney who was prosecuting me,
right,
this Karl Rove's best friend, but he was also running my Republican opponent's campaign against me.
The campaign manager for Bob Riley, who's running against you.
Right. So my prosecutor's husband, Karl Rove's best friend, was running my opponent's campaign. Now, let me explain why Karl Rove gets into Alabama. People say, wait a minute, who cares about Alabama? You know, well, after the 92 Bush-Quayle campaign,
mm-hmm.
The husband of my prosecutor, who had been a special assistant to Bush 1, who had worked with Andrew Carr, and he was the chief of staff to the NRC. He ran the ground troops working with Karl Rove for the 1992 Bush-Quayle campaign. After they lost, both of them, Karl Rove and the husband of my prosecutor, came to Alabama. They both found their wives in Alabama. Karl Rove married a girl from Mobile. He settled on the Gulf Coast in a place called Rosemary Beach, where he has his home today.
Mm-hmm.
Karl Rove and the husband of my prosecutor worked a bunch of campaigns out of Alabama, in Alabama, trying to take over the Alabama Supreme Court, as well as running a campaign for the state attorney general and other races. But I started doing battle with Rove back in 1994 when he was trying to steal his first election in the state of Alabama. And but anyway, that's how Karl Rove came to know me, and,
right.
and I guess came to decide that I was somebody that needed to be dealt with, because I kept winning elections in the face of his efforts to defeat me. And
you did, and I guess you were the governor just one term in 1999 through 2003. And in that 2002 election, I've always been impressed, Governor, because you've been able to, you've just come out and said it. You went to bed in 2002, you thought you were the winner, and then you woke up in the morning, and what, a Republican district, they found, what was it, 13,000 extra votes?
Well, I went to bed as the winner. I had won the election the day of the election. I had won. In the wee hours of the morning, after the lights in the courthouse in the South Alabama Republican county had gone off, the votes were recapitulated in the in the basement in the sheriff's office, and they took 5,000 votes from my column, electronically shifted them over to my opponent's column. The interesting thing here, Brad, is that by taking 5,000 votes from the Democratic column for me and moving it to the Republican column for Bob Riley, it did not change a single down ballot race. Not one other vote was changed. So how they managed to do that and get away with it is beyond me. But
only your election had the numbers that needed to be corrected on that. And I think it was a Diebold tabulator, wasn't it, that you guys use out there, a Diebold system in Alabama?
I believe that's correct. And yeah. the two people who took credit for that were, one was Karl Rove's partner, a woman named Kitty McCullough, who later changed her name to Kelly Kimbrough. But anyway, that's another story. And also a guy who went to work for Jack Abramoff immediately thereafter. Interestingly, John McCain, in his report to Congress about where Jack Abramoff was spending all these millions of dollars of Indian casino money, came up with emails from Jack Abramoff and to Jack Abramoff from Ralph Reed, who was the Christian Coalition fame. So they documented that $13 million from Jack Abramoff, who is I refer to as Karl Rove's bagman. They documented $13 million came into Alabama to defeat me in 1998 in my first election, to defeat the education lottery proposal, which was the genesis of my legal situation now,
right.
and also to defeat me in 2002. And again, Abramoff money comes in 2002. The guy that claims he stole the votes goes to work for Abramoff immediately after the election. It's all very curious.
Curious is a nice way to put it, and we haven't even gotten to the prosecution now and what it is they pulled in 2006 and the information that has now come out. I'm going to have to ask you to hold, if you don't mind, during the break. I want to get to that new information. And frankly, as I've said, you know, Eric Holder has dropped that Ted Stevens case up in Alaska, a Republican case, and a couple of other Republican officials up there. That case, frankly, your case and what we're now seeing makes the prosecutorial misconduct up in Alaska look like jaywalking, as far as I'm concerned. Not only should your case be thrown out, but the prosecutors, the attorneys, many of whom are still in the job, frankly, charges need to be brought against them. We're going to go into some of those specifics with Governor Don Siegelman from Alabama right after this break. I'm Brad Friedman in for Malloy. Governor, thanks for hanging in there. We're going to talk to you right after this. Stick with us. Program. program, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com in for Malloy. We're speaking with Governor Don Siegelman of Alabama, who is facing what I think is one of the most outrageous political prosecutions I have ever seen. He's currently out of jail on appeal, has now motioned for a new trial in this so-called bribery case. And we saw new evidence coming out this week. I wrote about it at bradblog.com because I was just blown away by the way the federal prosecutors were revealed to have manipulated the star witness of this case, the one who claims, who makes the claim about this check that was given from Richard Scrushy over to the governor for use in the educational lottery fund, a campaign that he was working on in Alabama to improve education. And as the saying goes, the governor put this Scrushy fella on the hospital oversight board out there in Alabama. In return for the payment, problem is, Scrushy had been on the same board under three former administrations. And when you take a look at this evidence, and Governor Siegelman, I'm going to let you talk a little bit about the evidence, but let me read this piece from the transcript. Because not only does it appear that they manipulated the witness, they also, the feds, didn't turn over the material that they should have from these 70 or so meetings with this star witness. Okay, in the trial, the judge asked the prosecutor, he said, first of all, I need to confirm whether the government has had the opportunity to confer with all of the investigative agencies, law enforcement officials who were involved in the investigation of each of the defendants in this case, and has discovered that there has not been exculpatory material that would be available to the defendants. Now, the acting U.S. attorney, Lewis Franklin, says in reply, Your Honor, we did. We checked with all the agents. They have no other reports that have been turned over in this matter. The agents even contacted the IRS agents who participated early on in this investigation and who were not participating in some of the instances where Mr. Bailey, this key witness, Nick Bailey, was interviewed. They have no additional reports. This is what the prosecutor said in court. Okay. He goes on to say the AG's office has also confirmed by going through its file that there are no additional reports regarding Mr. Bailey, the key, the star witness for the government. Governor Siegelman, from these new declarations that have been filed in your case, it appears that Mr. Franklin is out and out not telling the truth, that there was, what, some 60 or 70 meetings that Bailey had with the prosecutor and only a handful of them were turned over to your defense team?
Yeah, I think there were maybe 8 or 9 documents that were turned over by the government, but as it turns out, there were some 70 interviews with this witness, and of course he had disclosed on CBS's 60 Minutes in February of 2008 that he had been interviewed over 70 times and that he had been made to keep his answers, write his answers in a notebook, a three-ring notebook, because the government got so frustrated with him because he would not say what they wanted him to say, so they made him write it down until he got it right.
They wrote down, they said, we're going to write down our questions and we want you to write down the answers. And then, by the way, this notebook where they wrote down the questions, where he wrote down his answers, that was not turned over to your defense team. And as it turns out, some folks who have now, your attorneys who have now looked at this, actually Scrushy's team, I think his investigators have looked at it, and they said there was answers written down that Nick Bailey says, this isn't my handwriting, and his attorney says, this isn't my handwriting either. They were writing these answers, telling them what to say, Governor.
Apparently they were coaching him on the legal language that they needed him to repeat in order to complete their circle, their conspiracy circle and their circle for the jury. But there are documents that have been withheld that we could have used to cross-examine the witness. There were documents that they withheld that we believe are exculpatory. In other words, would have shown that I was not guilty. There were
we have a number of witnesses that are willing to testify that Nick Bailey told them that he was coached, he was led to say things that he now believes, he can't even believe that he actually said those things in court.
Because he was facing jail time himself. He was hoping, they said they kept basically walking him to the gallows for his sentencing and then pulling him back, and he was trying to get a short sentence if he could.
Yeah, well, this process went on for about 5 years. And during that period, they threatened him with a 40-year prison sentence. They threatened his brother with going to prison. And finally, this guy, it's sort of like waterboarding. You know, after you've been waterboarded 70 times, you finally just say, just tell me what it is you want me to say, and I'll say it.
Governor, I got to get out. 10 seconds. What can people do to help you here real quick?
One, say a prayer. Two, say a prayer for Eric Holder that he changes out these Republican prosecutors, and let's get some fair-minded people in that we can deal with.
Thank you, brother. We will talk more about this after the break, but I got to let you go. Thank you, Governor, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much, Brad.
You bet. All right, Brad in from Malloy. Back after this.
Every city, election reform, like Iraq or Ukraine, election reform in the USA. We don't believe.
That's it, singing Shannon. It's our buddy Shannon Williford from down in Nashville. We're going to talk about election reform with John Bonifaz, legal director of Voter Action, shortly. I'm going to try to get in a couple of calls, some folks who called in during the Don Siegelman interview that we didn't get to, so hang on there. I'll get to those quickly, and then over to Bonifaz. Brad Friedman in for Malloy. Introducing the all-new Chevy Equinox with an EPA estimated 32 miles per gallon highway. Well, that's good. And up to 600 highway miles on a tank. Well, that's good, too. It's the most fuel-efficient crossover on the highway. Go to Chevy.com/Equinox. Based on GM compact crossover segments, excludes other GM vehicles. All right. Let me get real quick to Stephen, since he's out here in Burbank, after all. Stephen, a quick thought on the Siegelman interview, Siegelman case there.
Okay, Brad. Well, ask any political science professor or historian, and they will tell you one of the most favorite tactics of an unjust power structure is to eliminate the political opposition. And if you get a guy in there who's going to bring college education to the, quote, unwashed masses, unquote, that is a threat to the power structure. And I also have a little sidebar about you being accused of being a right-wing caller.
Yes.
Well, a talker. Well, I talked to a right-wing guy who's one of either liberal handed your other guy's favorite guys, and I got him to listen to KTLK. I asked him about it later. I asked him what you think. He said, "Oh, I heard right wing stuff." And I said, "Well, what did you hear?" And I said, "Well, they were blasting Democrats. They were picking on Democrats and blasting them. You know." And now that gives you an insight as to how they think.
That's right wing. Well, of course, because those guys. Hey, if you're a Republican, no criticism, no nothing. God forbid a progressive should beat up on a Democrat. They don't get it. They really don't get it. And you know what? If they listened to progressive radio more often, if they could find it, if they listened to K-Talk, they would find out that progressivism does not equal Democrat. Progressivism does not even equal liberal. There's a lot of very conservative ideals in progressivism. Oh, like the rule of law. Follow the Constitution. Don't let these guys like Karl Rove get away with the crap that they did by twisting and bending the laws and using the Department of Justice as a political bludgeon, as they did in not just Don Siegelman's case, but in case after case. They prosecuted Democrats at a rate of 5-1. That is illegal, period. And we need to restore justice at justice. And let me use that to plug my organization, velvetrevolution.us. We've got a campaign, restorejusticeatjustice.com. Please go on over there, make your voice heard, sign on to that campaign, and call for the not just the Siegelman case to be vacated, but Eric Holder needs to look at all of the prosecutions during the Bush era and toss out those that were political prosecutions. Stephen, any more thoughts for you?
Well, what it is like we just have to keep pushing. And don't give too much credence to Eric Holder, because we have to remember this is a deep, dark thought, and I hope it's not true. He is subject to the unjust power structure, and that is corporate, top of one-tenth, you know, multinational cartel. So I don't know what to do except keep pushing it. I don't know what
keep
to
pushing,
do.
Keep pushing. Keep making noise out there, Stephen. Really appreciate it, and especially pushing those wing nuts to listen to some of the truth over here on Progressive Radio. Much appreciated, Stephen. Let me get to John in Scottsdale. John, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show.
You stole my thunder, Brad. You did a beautiful job with that idea. My concern is Siegelman's absolutely right, but he spent time pointing out that Roe was had relations in Louisiana, in Alabama. But if you look at this thing that Roe has put in place, it's national. And you find cases like that in Mississippi, New York, California, Georgia, in a variety of places where the Department of Justice is being used as a political, and get this, a financial weapon against the opposing party. And the people overlook. I mean, millions of dollars can be spent on one of these court cases. And I wanted to add one more thing to your spiel is that they use it against Republicans. If a Republican isn't in line with what, say, in the Bush administration, with that particular policy, he's subject, Stevens, one of the best Republicans that you ever have as far as voting party line, bang, he must have stepped out of line and he's got a multi-million dollar suit. So you're doing a great job, and you did steal my thunder, damn you.
Sorry about that, John.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Well, that's what us right-wingers do, you know that.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you very much.
All right, appreciate the call, John. Thanks a bunch. What's going on in this Justice Department? People, you have to make noise. You have to participate. You have to, call your legislator, demand that they restore justice to justice on all of these cases like Siegelman's. And we don't know how many there were. That's why at restorejustice@justice.com, we are calling on Holder to investigate how many of these prosecutions were actually political. RestoreJustice@justice.com. This has got to stop, and we're going to talk about more about it tomorrow night. Glenn Greenwald is going to join us for tomorrow night's show, as is Greg Palast. I believe he called me during one of the breaks here. He's going to be with us tomorrow night because, Greenwald is ticked, and I'm right there with him because, Holder, we've got news today that Eric Holder, quote, has told associates he's weighing a narrow investigation for torture, focusing only on CIA interrogators and contract employees who clearly crossed the line and violated the Bush administration's guidelines. Their guidelines were illegal, people. What does it take to get this message across to you? Across to you, Mr. Holder. Across to you, Mr. Obama. Okay. We're going to switch gears. We'll come back to that in the last hour, and we'll open the phones. We're going to talk about Sarah Palin, but we'll open the phones any damn thing you want to talk about. But I want to get to John Bonifaz, because all of this comes down to elections. And if you can't count on the elections, if you don't know, if you can't throw the bums out, and I don't care which side of the aisle the bums are on, if you can't throw them out, then it doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot. And we've got a serious problem with our election system. As you heard, Governor Siegelman talked about it. He had paper ballots, by the way, back in 2002. It wasn't the ballots they messed with. It was the tabulators. And they, according to Governor Siegelman, they switched the votes in the middle of the night on the tabulators. And then they never let anyone see the paper ballots. Secret software, secret counting. That's trouble. We're trying to do something about it. I'm joined tonight by my friend, John Bonifaz, the legal director of Voter Action. That's voteraction.org. Prior to joining Voter Action, John worked for more than a dozen years with the National Voting Rights Institute, an organization that he founded in 1994. And he was on Capitol Hill, I believe, today, trying to get them moving in D.C. on election reform. He and I agree on most things. We've got a few disagreements about the latest legislation, but we'll get there in a bit. John Bonifaz, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show.
Thank you, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for staying up late out there. I know it's been a long day. Were you actually testifying, or were they in committee today out there in D.C.? What's going on with election reform? Everybody thinks, oh, problem solved, nothing to worry about now, but that ain't the case, is it?
Well, we were, no, it's definitely not the case. We were releasing a report that we have authored jointly with Advancement Project and the NAACP National Voter Fund, and we were presenting it before the House Administration Committee at a hearing it held today,
right,
dealing with these issues. The report is based on data from two major voter hotlines, the CNN and MyVote1 voter hotline, mm-hmm, in 2008, and it highlights that despite the decisive outcome that occurred at the presidential level, this was not a trouble-free election. Anyone who thinks that somehow we've moved beyond the problems of 2000-2004, it does not have the right facts. The facts, unfortunately, are that we have a long way to go to protect our vote and protect our democracy.
We do indeed. And these calls were stunning. And I believe that these were calls, as you said, to the caller hotlines that came in on Election Day and I guess earlier during the election, the early election period. I'd like to play. You put together a montage a couple of minutes here of some of the calls.
Yeah.
Let me play those to give an idea. Just a sampling of, you've got hundreds and hundreds of these, is that correct?
Tens of thousands, actually. Nearly 70,000 people on Election Day called reporting the problems they were facing at the polls.
And these are, give you just an idea of some of those problems that were being faced all over the country.
Presently at Velda City polling place in St. Louis, Missouri, in North County, voters who've been waiting since 10 this morning have not been able to vote. There is inadequate equipment. It is very, very poorly organized. And as a result of that, many voters have left.
My issue and complaint is in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Ward 59, Division 4. Only one of two machines working this morning at 7 a.m. when the polls opened, although there were already more than 200 people standing in line.
My name is Robert. I'm calling from Pensacola, Florida. I've been in the Army for several years, and I now live in Pensacola. And in order to vote here, I have to have a Florida ID. So I went to get a Florida ID, and all of a sudden, on the 1st of October, they've changed the rules. Well, I have to have a birth certificate, which means I have to go back to my state and get a birth certificate, come back to Florida to get an ID just to vote. And there won't be enough time to do that between now and when the votes actually take place.
I'm a student in the University of Miami, and I just finished voting in voting precinct 561. People were turned away. People were leaving lines. There were three lines attempting to funnel through the door. They were unable to locate my name, even though I presented my voter registration card and my ID. It is the biggest disaster that I've ever seen.
I had trouble at the voting booth this morning. I put the access card in. It beeped. It did not advance. I pushed it in a little further again, and then it said I voted, and I did not. I never saw the screen advance. And I approached the woman, the voting person there, and they said, well, sorry, you already voted. Well, I don't know who I voted for, so that was my problem.
I'm calling from Chesapeake, Virginia, in the Crestwood area. We are having problems at that location, Crestwood Middle School. We have thousands of people in line. They only have six voting machines, and they're all down.
I'm in Douglasville, Pennsylvania. The problem I'm having at our polling station was we were voting, and I don't know if there was something wrong with the polling machine, but the polling machine was voting double or triple for whatever candidate you chose.
On Saturday, my husband and I tried to vote in Orange County, Florida, and were told that we were purged from the system. When I renewed our driver licenses at the Division of Motor Vehicle, we were asked if we wanted to also change our voter registration address. We agreed to do that. However, we were told by a supervisor of elections at the poll that 90% of the changes made at the DMV are never passed on to the supervisor of elections.
John Bonifaz, unbelievable. Those calls are not... there's a lot more of them. They're representative of thousands of calls, right? These aren't these weren't unusual to the calls that you guys received at the voter hotline on Election Day last November.
No, they're unfortunately not unusual. They were part of really the pattern that we saw in so many places in the country where people were facing these kinds of barriers in accessing the ballot and having their votes be properly counted. And I think the story that's coming out of this report today and to hear these voices again from the voters themselves is that we have to be vigilant in continuing the fight to protect the right to vote and the integrity of our elections. I should say that we've uploaded 900 plus calls from these various states that we're focusing on via this report: Florida, Missouri, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Virginia. And these calls really do give the broad sense of the array of problems that voters faced on Election Day and our call for reform to protect the 2010 election.
And we're going to talk about your call for reform after this break. Speaking with John Bonifaz of VoterAction.org on their new report. Brad Friedman in for Malloy. John, stick around a little bit. We're going to talk to you about reform and if we have a chance of seeing that ever happen. Brad in for Malloy. Stick with us.
Jojo left his home in Tucson, Arizona, for some California grass.
Friedman in for Mike Malloy, speaking with John Bonifaz of VoterAction.org. VoterAction.org. There you go. On his new report today, these startling, these troubling phone calls that came in on Election Day to the voter hotlines out there, and they're not unusual. The trouble is, John Bonifaz, I was looking at the database, Barack Obama's database, the DNC database, in the days leading up to the election. Their error database or their own hotline. Problem after problem exactly like this. And as far as I could tell, the Democrats and Barack Obama, unfortunately, were not doing much about it. Your thoughts, John?
Well, I don't know whether I would agree that they were not doing much about it. They had their own independent operation, obviously, that was a partisan operation. We were not connected to it in any way because we're a strictly nonpartisan organization. We were monitoring the data.
But there was touchscreen machines that were flipping votes all over the country, and they weren't pulling them out of service. And when Republicans see that happen to them, that's what they do. They sequester those machines. They get them the hell out of service. The Democrats don't seem to be taking this seriously, and I'm not trying to get you to beat up on Democrats here. I'm saying this by way of saying that Democrats are now in control. Rush Holt, congressman from New Jersey, has a bill that I know you support. It will require paper ballots eventually, 2014, it'll require paper ballots finally for everybody. But A, can they get it passed? And B, is it enough? And C, do you have the same concerns I do about the secret software still in that bill?
So let me address those questions, but let me just come back to the issue of what happens during an election cycle, because I think they are separate and distinct questions. The issue of whether partisan operations can be counted on to engage in those kinds of things like taking machines out of commission or fighting on every single possible front to protect the right to vote is precisely why we need a nonpartisan, vibrant nonpartisan voting rights community, because there are strategic political decisions that are made that are not necessarily about whether the right to vote gets fought for during an election or during a campaign. So that's just my point on that there may have been some other strategic political decisions that may or may not have been the right decisions, but are not always with the lens of how do we engage in small d democracy. And that is why we need to kind of have this monitoring that we've discussed via this report that was done during the election. Now, as for the Holt bill, Yes, we are very strongly endorsing this bill, and there's language in this report calling for voter mark paper ballots. That is why we need this bill. Had we had a choice in terms of where it should go, we certainly would say that everything should be overhauled by 2010. To be clear, the paper ballot requirement is there for paperless jurisdictions by 2010, and then for 2014 for jurisdictions that have the printers attached to the areas, which are useless.
Exactly. Continues the fiction that those touchscreens, if they have a paper trail, that they're somehow better.
We agree on that. As for where the bill is going, it's our view that it needs to be pushed by the grassroots community in order for it to go anywhere, and it already has a broad array of endorsers. We did not get behind the prior bill, as you know, Brad, because it did not ban electronic voting. This bill does, and in our view, that's a significant advancement. As for the secret software question, were we litigating in Sarasota, fighting to get access to the machines, to get access to the underlying source code and the source materials, with this particular bill as law?
John, I gotta get to a hard break. I want to be fair, though. Can you stick around just for a minute at the top of the hour? Okay. John Bonifaz, back with more right after this. Friedman in for an ailing Mike. He will be back with you on Monday, which means I will be back with you tomorrow night. Get over it. We will have Glenn Greenwald and Greg Palast at the very least with us. I think Desi Doyen's going to join us tomorrow for some green news. Your calls, your rants, everything else. I got John Bonifaz I want to finish up with here in a quick second, but a tease that A.K. Muckraker, one of the great Alaska bloggers, and there are a bunch of them, and frankly, this country owes these Alaska bloggers a great deal for what they did. They really showed what the citizen media was all about last year, and they're still doing it. For this woman, what's her name? Palin, that's right, who is quitting as of Saturday. Her crappy job as governor. She's going to do a crappy job, apparently, as a celebrity citizen community organizer. That's right. All right, John, let me get to John Bonifaz from voteraction.org. We were talking about election reform that is having trouble getting moving, frankly. It's been quite disappointing. The Democrats haven't done more about it. Congressman Rush Holt has a bill. His bill, he's been introducing it session after session after session. It is better than it was before. I will grant you that. It will finally ban touchscreen DRE systems by 2014, so we've got to go through this stuff again. These phone calls you played from your report at voteraction.org, these startling hotline phone calls. But it still allows for the secret software, which I believe is a threat to democracy, the privatization of our elections, these corporations who run our elections with secret software. And I wanted to give you a chance, John, to respond to that, because I know that you support wholeheartedly support the current version of the Holt bill.
Well, we do. We do support the bill. To be clear, I'm in agreement with you that ultimately we shouldn't have the kind of secret software that's involved with our voting systems. However, under current law, it is a lot more difficult to get access to the underlying source materials than it would be if this bill were to become law. In election contests, as the one we had in Sarasota, where, as you know, over 18,000 votes went missing on electronic voting machines.
Disappeared entirely.
We had a contest. We were in court on behalf of voters. along with other public interest organizations. And ultimately, the courts found that the alleged trade secrets of ESNS, the company that owned those, you know, marketed those machines, were able to trump. Those trade secret arguments were able to somehow trump the integrity of our election, protecting the vote. We were not able to get access to the machines. Were this bill to become law, that would provide a whole different avenue to being able to access that kind of material in an election contest, and I think that's an advancement. It doesn't get us to open source. It doesn't get us to the broader reform that you and I agree on, but it's a step forward.
Well, I, by the way, I don't know that I agree on open source, but that's another issue. It would allow, you're an attorney, an election attorney, you were involved in that suit in Sarasota. It would allow you and your team to look at the source code as needed in those cases. But that said, it's very rare that anyone can afford to bring an election suit like that. It's in the rarest of cases. And my concern is not, you know, I'll be glad that someone like you could get at that software, but it's my opinion that the citizens ought to be able to see their votes counted, to know that their votes were counted accurately, and not have to wait for a close election and then hope an attorney gets interested and then hope that this bill would allow the election attorney to see that software. I mean, this is, as Tom Hartman likes to call it, the heartbeat of our democracy, the vote. And when we can't see how our votes are counted, I would suggest we lose democracy altogether. And it's kind of asking for scraps, isn't it, to say, well, please let us see it after an election, if there's a contest.
The question is, does this bill advance matters forward? And I think it does. It does not, as some people have tried to argue, somehow sanction or cement into the law secret software. I don't agree with that. What it does do is it provides different avenues, new avenues that are not available right now for people to access those kinds of materials in an election contest. But when it comes to the broader reform, I'm in agreement with you that we shouldn't have private companies ultimately controlling our elections. What is important about this bill is that it ensures that we are finally going to shift away from the use of unreliable, insecure electronic voting machines, and we're going to have paper ballot-based systems, you know, in every state in the country by 2014 and certainly by 2010 in those states that have these machines without even the printer attached. But the printer, as you and I agree, is a meaningless device. It doesn't change the reliability or security of the machine. Were we to have our choice, we would have everything be done by 2010. But, you know, does this bill ultimately move us forward? It does, and that's why we're behind it. And we were not behind the prior bills that Holt introduced because they kept the printers in place. They kept the DRE electronic voting machines.
Touchscreens, yeah. Well, and you and I have agreed to disagree for the moment on this because, you know, it was because you and I and some of the other groups stood strong, I think. And on the last bill, which would not ban touchscreen machines, when
correct,
all the folks in Congress were saying, well, we can't ban touchscreen machines, it's impossible, it's a non-starter, we said, well, then we don't care, we don't support the bill. And what do you know, the new bill comes out and it includes a ban on touchscreens. Yes, down the road too many years, but it includes that ban. And I would suggest if we stood together and said no secret software in any election, that they might hear that message.
Well, the only other thing I would just say, Brad, because I know you have to move forward, yeah, on other things, but is that the battle here is not solely, you know, at the federal level. We continue to have the fight at the state level. We have litigation in Pennsylvania challenging use of electronic voting. The litigation is now going to trial. The Arizona Court of Appeals just ruled we're going to trial in Arizona on electronic voting. We're going to trial in Pennsylvania. We are going to continue to fight this at the state level because we recognize that, you know, Congress may not get this right and may not get this bill passed in time for 2010. And therefore, you know, we still got to do the work at the state level that's been done in New Mexico and California and Colorado and other states where we've been present.
Plenty of work for all of us, unfortunately, to do. Thank you, John Bonifaz of VoterAction.org, for being willing to do it. Hope you don't mind when I hold your feet to the fire. I expect you'll do the same for me when it's merited. Thanks.
Thank you, Brad. Honor to be on your show.
Thank you, brother. Honor to have you. All right. John Bonifaz, VoterAction.org. Do check out their new report. Hear those phone calls. folks, it's bad out there. This is, you know, this is what is going on around the country. It's not an unusual situation. Those phone calls that we played in the last hour, these people who are, you know, having trouble with their voting machines, the machines are down, there's long lines, very few working, they can't vote because of these new voter ID restrictions that are purposely meant to keep them from not, keep them from being able to cast their legal vote. The forces against democracy, the evil forces against democracy, aren't going away. They're raising their game. We got to raise ours, and we can't wait until 2 weeks before the next election to start giving a damn about it. We got to fight now. We got to make noise now. I'm going to go to a break, come back with AK Muckraker so I don't have to cut her off. Up in Alaska. It's early in Alaska. She can wait. I hope you don't mind, Gene. Hang in there. Ooh, did I say Gene? Is AK Muckraker out? She is now. Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy. We're talking Sarah Palin after this. Got an opinion? 877-520-1150. Questions, opinions about Sarah Palin. Now's the time to get them in. Back after this.
See-through shields are walled across the way that you came in. Flashback blazers and ate all your razors while pulling the waiters, talking about Monroe and walking on Snow White. New York's a go-go and everything tastes nice. Poor little greenie.
To the Mike Malloy Show, Brad Friedman, your friendly citizen, investigative blogger, troublemaker, muckraker, journalist from bradblog.com. I am joined by a fellow traveler here. This one is traveling up in the 49th state. 49? Yeah, Hawaii was last, that's right. 49th state. Known as A.K. Muckraker, A.K.A. Gene Devon, of themudflats.net, one of the great bloggers up there in Alaska. She joins us right now to discuss, Sarah Palin. By the way, we'll take your calls, 877-520-1150. If you have a question about Citizen Palin, who quits officially on Saturday. Hey, Gene, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show.
Thank you, Brad. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. You heard that we played Gene Genie for you.
I did. That was, yes, a flashback.
And, of course, I wasn't going to tell anybody why we were playing it unless I knew for a fact that you were out, so to speak. You went for years as just A.K. Muckraker.
Well, I went for about a year, yeah.
About a year?
As A.K. Muckraker, and then...
And you were outed not of your own choosing.
No, it was actually kind of an interesting story. I was outed by one of my own state legislators, ironically a Democrat.
maybe not so ironically anymore, I'm sorry to say. So, yeah, what did he do? To remind us of that story. It was an amazing story.
Yeah, it kind of was. I had, I like to think I'm sort of an equal opportunity, blogger, and when I see a Democrat behaving badly, I like to call them out on it as well. And he had...
That makes you a right-winger, apparently. Earlier this show, I was told I was a right-winger because I was beating up on Democrats. But anyway.
Really?
Go figure. So you were beating up on the right-winger because he deserved it, and he said...
Yeah, he was being very rude to his own constituents via email. And he was sort of sending out these bulk emails with everyone's emails exposed, telling people that, basically asking him to push for the continuance of the Troopergate in- investigations involving Governor Palin, telling them to quit spamming him and to sort of, you know, go back to wherever they came from if they weren't his constituent. And he was really being very rude. So I called him out on that, and he didn't like that much, not knowing who I was and being told he was rude. So he kind of made it a mission to sort of figure out who I was, and eventually did, and outed me after a sort of email. He had said, you know, I know who you are, and tomorrow I'm going to out you. And so he did in his legislative newsletter, using state resources and state emails and the whole thing.
And so let's out him. Kind of, what was his name again?
Mike Dugan.
Mike Dugan. Now, have you guys... kissed and made up, so to speak, or is
I have not spoken to him since. I am on the understanding that he believes that he did the right thing, and in his opinion, you should not be able to state your opinion without putting your name on it, which, you know, I mean, the First Amendment certainly allows us anonymous political speech, and that's been the case since, you know, the Federalist Papers and before. There's a history, certainly in America, of anonymous political speech, and it's actually one of the more protected speeches. They say it protects from the tyranny of the majority.
I'm glad you're out, as it were, in that case, because while pseudonymous bloggers and writers, as you say, they certainly are protected, but when I see someone who's willing to put their name next to something, it causes me to take it a lot more seriously. And the fact that a Democratic legislator would out you just because he felt like it, just because he did, you know, as retribution.
Right.
I think is reprehensible. Now, why were you not out in the first place? Why did you prefer to write pseudonymously?
Well, when I first started the blog, I really had no intention of anybody else actually reading it. It was sort of a lark.
I know the feeling, Jean.
And I did it really more for myself and for fun, and just because I had things, you know, bouncing around in my head, and I thought, you know, I'm tired of ranting at all the people I know. I need to just sort of get this out in writing. And a friend of mine suggested that I start a blog, and so it was just kind of a lark. It wasn't anything, you know, the first day when I had 8 readers, I was floored. I couldn't believe it, you know, that there were other people actually reading what I wrote. So I had never started this with the intention of, you know, being a journalist or being a news reporter or being anybody that, you know, was going to have an audience larger than 8. So it really didn't seem necessary to put my name on it. It wasn't anything that I wasn't looking for any type of recognition. And then after Sarah Palin got nominated, obviously, you know, well, my traffic went through the roof.
Yeah.
Just because people were going, Sarah who?
Right.
You know, there was a day when we didn't know who she was, or when the lower 48 didn't know who she was. And so at that time, then it became a little bit strange to have your name on things where you were being critical of the governor, you know, especially if you were, you know, a person who had any involvement in the community. And I thought, you know, this isn't the time where I'm going to start putting my name on it now. I haven't up to this point, and I really would rather not. So
right.
There wasn't anything nefarious or, you know, creepy about being anonymous. It was just something that I chose to do. So.
And when did Mike Dugan, that creep, actually out you? What period was that?
It was the end of March.
So he at least had the courtesy to wait until after the election passed.
Oh, I'm sure if he had known beforehand, he wouldn't have given me the courtesy. But
yeah.
That's just kind of how it worked out.
Yeah, well, thanks for being brave there. All right, well, we're going to get into everyone's famous, soon-to-be former ex-governor quitter,
yes.
Sarah Palin, in a moment. I do have to take a break, though. We're speaking with Jean Devin, otherwise known as, well, let's say, A.K. Muckraker. Did you get that? Check her out at themudflats.net or over on HuffingtonPost.com. Yeah, plenty popular. Lots of comments. We're going to talk about Palin and this latest ethics report. Probable cause has been found that she broke some ethics. Go figure. What? Sarah Palin? Breaking ethics? Violating ethics? 877-520-1150 is our number. We will take your calls and talk with Jean. And, I also found out that it's time to sue Sarah Palin and her attorney. Much more on that after this break. Brad, in for Malloy. Stick with us. in your eyes, Sarah. Brad Friedman back on the Mike Malloy show, speaking with Gene Devin up there in Alaska, also known as A.K. Muckraker from the great blog, themudflats.net. And if you haven't read it, if you haven't read her work up there, it is stupendous, along with so many of the other local bloggers up there who really saved the day back in 2008. It was the citizen media who made the difference up there. And, well, Gene was saying the media needed some help because they didn't know what the heck was going on up in Alaska. I would suggest they needed help in all 50 states. Luckily, the folks in Alaska were there and did such a great job that they were covered in Eric Bollert's new book, which I highly recommend, Bloggers on the Bus. Read the chapter entitled Sarah Dice Lost. We're going to speak more with Gene in a moment. Take your calls at 877-520-1150. But first, you're invited to the Chevy Open House. We've made it easy to get into a new Chevy with low, straightforward pricing on remaining 08 and 09 models. It's simple. The price on the tag is the price you pay. Oh, I get it. Price on the tag is the price you pay. That makes sense. Go to Chevy.com/open house for details. Excludes Corvette ZR1 at participating dealers only. And as I like to say, come on, people. We got cars to move. All right. Gene, thanks for sticking with us here. Want to talk about this latest news about Sarah Palin, and it's, boy, for those of us in the lower 48, as you like to say, it's tough to make sense of this one. Give us very briefly this report that leaked out. What exactly whose report is it, and what exactly does it say?
Well, we had a citizen, Kim Chapman is her name, and
right.
She filed an ethics complaint against the governor, and the long and short of it is that the ethics complaint stated or asked for an opinion about whether her legal defense fund, Palin's legal defense fund, was in itself legal. Because there are a couple of provisions in the Executive Branch Ethics Act, one of which says it prohibits a public officer's use of an official position for personal gain.
Right.
And the second prohibits a public officer from accepting gifts that are intended to influence the performance of official duties. So those were the two bits of statute that she felt that could be violated by having this legal defense fund. And the legal defense fund is called the Alaska Fund Trust, which we all thought was very hubristic
right.
Name for her legal defense fund.
Right.
And the trustee for the fund is named Kristen Cole. And Kristen Cole is a longtime friend of Sarah Palin's. I believe they knew each other at Wasilla High School.
Right.
And she has also been appointed to various boards and commissions by the governor over the years. And so she is the trustee. So that was all what was up under question.
And what they found was, as you said, the probable cause that, in fact, she did use her public position, that she allowed this to be called the official legal defense fund. She allowed her photograph to be used along with it. And now we should say this was supposedly just a preliminary report. It was not supposed to leak out just yet.
Well, that's sort of in question, because now the fact that this has leaked out, it was supposed to be confidential, and there's all sorts of speculation about who leaked this report to the Associated Press.
Right.
But Tom Daniel is the investigator,
mm-hmm.
Because once it goes to the personnel board, which is the body that determines what's, you know, whether this is in fact legal or not, it goes out to a private investigator. He did his thing, and this is his final report. The Palin administration has been trying to spin this and sort of wiggle out in all sorts of ways, and by, one of the ways was by saying, well, this isn't the final report.
Oh, I see.
But
so it's
Tom Daniel actually spoke with NPR and said, no, this is it. This is my finding. And he made recommendations for a way that the governor could sort of get out of this and make everything okay. And his recommendation was that she needs to give the money back.
Although she has not received yet any of that trust fund money, correct? The legal defense fund money, yet.
That's what they say, but the other portion of this is that the legal defense fund money is supposed to go directly to her attorney. So are they parsing words and saying, well, she hasn't gotten any of it yet because it actually went to her attorney? So we don't know. There's still a lot of this that has to come out yet, and some of it is still speculation.
Are you suggesting that Sarah Palin and her attorney, Thomas Van Flyn, is it Flyn or Flayne? Thomas Van Flyn, I'll just say Flyn, that he would parse words? Now, these are the guys.
I know.
Thomas Van, I know you know, but I want to make sure everybody else understands. After the 4th of July, well, on July 3rd, when Sarah Palin announced she was quitting because she's a quitting quitter, when the speculation came up about why she was quitting, Bradblog.com certainly reported, a lot of other folks did, we were one of the first to report what folks in Alaska were talking about, and it was this quote-unquote iceberg scandal that had been rumored for several weeks concerning that was perhaps about to hit, that it concerned her house in Wasilla, that she may have misappropriated funds and material and labor and so forth from the Wasilla sports complex. That was the talk from a lot of the sources that I talked to over the last 1 or 2 months. Now, in reply, Tom Van Flyn came out on the 4th of July, threatened one of the folks who was talking about it, Shannon Moore, who
right.
I know you know very well.
I do.
And as well, he also threatened a bunch of other mainstream media outlets for some odd reason who hadn't even talked about it.
Well, they were thinking about talking about it.
They were okay. They were thinking about talking about it. No
That's
wonder
good
he...
good enough, apparently.
Right. Threatened to shut down those bastards. So he comes out and says, we're going to be reviewing our options. It was defamatory what Shannon Moore said, that she stated as fact that Palin was under investigation. A, she never stated, quote, as fact. And this was he put quotes around this fact that she was, quote, under federal investigation. She never did any of that, yet
no.
He said she was possibly defaming. No, he said that she was defaming. Now, the reason I mention this is because yesterday, I guess, in response to this report that got leaked, they blamed Kim Chatman, the original
yes.
complainant for this,
mm-hmm.
and they said she leaked it, and therefore she committed illegal actions. That's what Thomas Van Flyn said about a private attorney. Now, it seems to me that unless he has evidence that she leaked it, and unless leaking it is illegal in the first place, and I'm not sure that it is, that in saying a private citizen has committed illegal actions, she has a defamation suit, a real one, against Thomas Van Flyn and Sarah Palin.
She certainly could, because she has actually come out and said that it was not her.
That she did not leak it.
I did not leak it. And, you know, certainly she's not the only one that has this piece of paper in her hands. That's why it's kind of really interesting.
Thomas Van Flyn has that piece of paper in his hands, doesn't he?
He does. The personnel board has it. Presumably members of Palin's inner circle have it. And this report has been out for about a week now. And the governor has taken no actions whatsoever. The fund, the Alaska Fund Trust, you can go to their website right now, is still accepting money. So this has been going on not only for the past week since this report came out, but presumably these investigators are in constant contact with both sides, both the complainant and with the Palin administration throughout this investigation. So this was not, I doubt that this was a surprise that the paper landed on the governor's desk and she had no idea this was coming. So presumably she's known for more than a week that this is seriously an issue and that his recommendations are that she can't be taking this money and that she needs to give it back, and yet the fund is still up and running and accepting money.
Well, that's right. And he also points out, Thomas Daniels, in his report, that in fact that she could, Palin could get the money from the state in the cases, in the ethics complaints where she was found not guilty, that
correct.
The state could actually give her back that money that they're there's already provisions for that in the law. But, you know.
And nobody has applied. The Thomas Van Flein has never asked the state to be paid.
That's right. He could get the money back, yet they're not asking for it. And nonetheless, Thomas Van Flein came out and stated as fact that Kim Chatman committed a, quote, illegal action. Actually, illegal actions. And I hope to hell someone sues them for defamation, that Kim Chatman, that an attorney wants to join in there and take these guys to task, because they have been trying to intimidate journalists, intimidate citizens, intimidate bloggers.
Right.
And enough is enough. It's time to push back.
A sad part about this, too, is actually the day after this report came out, Kim Chatman's father passed away.
Yeah, I know.
And
I
so
know.
That was on the day that they're saying, you know, she's committed illegal acts and we're going to get her, after she had denied that it was her that leaked it. And while she's going through all of this, she has now piled on top of her sort of this, you know, promised wrath of the Palin administration and Thomas Van Flein, you know, to take her to task for this.
It's
so
time
it's
to
really
push back, and I will join with the Alaska bloggers. I'll join with everybody in America to push back against the cowards and the bullies, as Shannon Moore called them.
They really are.
They really are.
I'll join her. They're bullies.
All right. Let me see if I can get in a quick call here before the break. Dave in San Francisco, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show. You have a question for Gene Devin.
Yeah, I sure did. And, yeah, this is a great discussion. You know, one of the first things that I did when I looked up, when she got nominated back in August of last year, Wasilla came up. So I did a brief Google of Wasilla, and it came up that it was the duct tape capital of the world. But it was the very year that the famous, I'm trying to think if it was anthrax or right after 9/11, the Homeland Security was saying that we should buy duct tape and plastic and, you know, seal our homes. And I'm just wondering, does she have, I have a number of questions, but this would be the first one. Does she go as far back as early 9/11? Was there some sort of an inside to Wasilla to give them a huge grant of largesse as duct tape sales would?
Appreciate that call, David. I got to get to a break. We'll get your answer from Gene Devin after this break. Hold on to your duct tape thoughts there, Gene.
Okay.
All right, we're going to be back to get that answer, take a couple more calls, and wrap up the night here on the Mike Malloy Show. Brad, in for Malloy with Gene Devin, A.K. Muckraker of the Mud Flats, back after this. Your Mike Malloy Show, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, in for Malloy, who's out sick. I'll be back with you tomorrow night, along with Glenn Greenwald and Greg Palast will be joining us. And then Mike will be back live, don't fear, next Monday. Speaking for our last few minutes here with A.K. Muckraker, otherwise known as Gene Devin of themudflats.net, one of the fabulous Alaska blogs who have saved the world for us. We're talking about Sarah Palin, who, as of this Saturday, she will have finally aborted her first term as governor to become the celebrity community organizer that apparently she always wished to be. Gene, did you did you get a chance to think about that Wasilla duct tape question? Is in fact Wasilla the duct tape capital of the world?
I did, you know, and when he was talking about Wasilla, my first thought and the thing that everybody says is that they hear that Wasilla is the meth capital of Alaska.
That's right.
I was actually expecting that question,
right?
But duct tape is pretty ubiquitous in the whole state. I don't know if I'd be able to single out Wasilla in particular, but we do all sorts of things with duct tape. We have making life-size boats out of duct tape and racing them, and all sorts of good Alaskan recreation.
I got it. Okay, so going back to 9/11, then no particular interest in Alaska, in Wasilla, going back.
I really couldn't. I couldn't say. That might warrant a little investigation.
Okay. Well, I want folks to go to themudflats.net and check out your coverage, in particular, of the claims being made by Palin and her crew, and now from Christine. Is it Christine? Christina Cole.
Kristen
Cole, who is who runs this trust fund, and says, "Oh, I went to school with Sarah Palin in high school, but oh, I never, ever, ever, ever talked to her about the trust fund at all. I just set it up all by myself and never even spoke with her until yesterday about it."
That was really quite unbelievable. She kind of came out with this 3-page, single space, tiny type press release that is just sort of a big panicky screed.
Yeah.
and claimed, because Tom Daniel had said that if the trust had been created by third parties without the knowledge of the governor, then it could be argued that she hadn't used her position to sort of garner this money. So they kind of glommed onto that and would like us all to believe that, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary and despite what's written in Mr. Daniel's report itself, what he determined was that, yes, Sarah Palin had sanctioned this, had said, yes, you can use my picture, said, yes, this is the official one, because there was another one that had popped up, this sort of rogue defense fund, and they all kind of panicked, because it was this guy in Texas who said, you know, I think she's swell, and Bill O'Reilly said that if somebody created a fund that he would donate to it.
And her attorney, Van Flynn, apparently told the guy, oh, that sounds good to me, you can just give me the money. And now, and you took a trip through the Mudflats time machine to look back, and in fact, she did. Well, she talked about we setting up this defense fund. Go check that out. I got to get out at themudflats.net. And also, just to toss this in, I'd suggest another ethics complaint needs to be filed before Sarah lets the door hit her on the way out, which is the fact that she is using the state website to post her private attorney's comments. That's private use, once again, using her official office for personal gain, as I see it. Imagine if Barack Obama started posting private attorney comments on the whitehouse.gov. That's what this is like. Someone needs to file a complaint. That's just my opinion, Gene.
Yep, she likes to blur the lines sort of between personal and private.
She do. Thanks, every
personal and public.
She do, indeed. Thanks for all you do, Gene. Really appreciate it. A.K. Muckraker, check her out at themudflats.net and at Huffington Post.
Thanks.
Great talking to you, Gene.
You too.
All right, bye-bye. All right, do I have this time? If Scott can get in this question, I want to get it in. Scott, give me your question or your thought in 10 seconds, please. Scott from Eugene, Oregon.
Yes, hey, thanks for taking my call.
You got to do it quick, though, because we're out of time.
I just wanted to comment on the health care reform and my concerns with the government being involved in something that's going to be so hugely, hugely expensive.
Yeah, you're against it, and I got to get out. You're against it?
I'm against it. It's going to have unintended consequences of physicians leaving the industry and reimbursement being decreased to the people who are working the hard.
Scott, I got to go. Physicians are not going to leave the industry. They're not going to quit because the government has anything to do with health care. Yeah, government ran two wars. They did fine. Why do you hate America, Scott? Hey, thanks, Tony Sorrentino. Thanks, Desi Doyen. Thanks, Mike and Kathy Malloy. Mike, get better. We'll be back tomorrow night. Brad Friedman. Until then, I'll see you at bradblog.com. Keep it lit.